My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Michelangelo Campanella, a new addition to the RBC staff, about his interests in mitochondria and the role that dysfunction of the mitochondria play in disease processes. So good morning, Michelangelo. I thought I could start off by asking you exactly what a mitochondrion is, just to introduce the subject to our listeners.
Yeah, good morning, Mark. Mitochondria is a really fascinating organelle for a variety of reasons. One of them is actually the reason why I started to be interested in mitochondria is because the mitochondria themselves take all the story of science. Mitochondria for years have been fields of interest just for biochemistry, and only recently, due to their involvement in disease and in basic physiology, became interested to a broader community of science. However, what is a mitochondria? Mitochondria is a simple an organelle with a double membrane and with all specific genetic packaging within it. And he lies in the cytosol.
Okay, so I mean, what exactly are the mitochondria doing within the cells?
Well, mitochondria are, I mean, as simplistically we can define them, are the powerhouse of the cells. So basically they produce ATP, and the fact that they produce ATP is the consequence of the capacity of coupling oxygen into energy used by the basic function of needed by the living cells. The extremely interesting and still somehow unclarified thing is that these mitochondria are probably a symbiotic that we have within our cells. So there is this theory that is coming back from the beginning of the last century and more recently recovered in some extent in the earliest of the 70s, was actually they say that mitochondria are a prokaryotic organism who colonized the eukaryotic cells millions and millions of years, teaching us, the cells which primarily colonized, to breathe.
So they're like sort of simple bacteria, basically, is the theory.
Yeah, probably mitochondria is really a symbiotic that is still actually living within cells. And this actually is, and this theory can be explained by some basic features of mitochondria, such as that they have their own DNA, I mean, rather than the genetic package of the cells. And this the old DNA, which actually is transmitted in vertical way from the cell's mother to the daughter.
So right.
This is quite fascinating. So, for example, I mean, it's been seen in other organisms is actually another organism. So let's just recall the plants, for example. Even the plants have this funny mitochondria which have the name of chloroplast. And without chloroplast, they wouldn't able to use the sun power to produce oxygen. And they could just live by glycolytic activities, such as probably also the other cells, the eukaryotic cells.
Okay, so if I get this right, I mean, basically, it's a symbiotic relationship between a very ancient organism which was incorporated into cells of a lot of higher animals. And obviously, it's important in coupling, as you say, oxygen uptake with production of energy through oxidation. But obviously, the cell can produce energy in other ways as well.
Yeah, this is a very good point. So we would be able to survive in some extent even without mitochondria because we produce our energy by glycolytic activity, which is occurring in the cytosol. However, mitochondria teach us or make us breathe better because they improve our capacity of producing energy.
Right.
And the symbiotic, of course, I mean, takes place by the fact that the DNA contains in the nucleus of the cells codify for certain proteins needed by mitochondria to improve the enzymatic machinery to transform oxygen in ATP. And also the symbionting is complete and a sort of vicious cycle. If you think that these organelles are not able to couple oxygen to ATP once they are outside of the eukaryotic host.
Right, I see. So the DNA of the cell expresses protein that the mitochondria needs to function, and of course in turn the mitochondria is providing energy for the cell and for the organism as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a symbiotic and successful symbiotic activity. And as you will say, through this chat on mitochondria, the protein I've been interested in is one of the proteins which regulates the activity of mitochondria. And the interesting thing, and this is a protein encoded by glycosylated DNA and not by mitochondria. So during the evolutionary pathway, probably some proteins have been overexpressed or created to control better mitochondria. Because as I will discuss later, mitochondria can be really extremely dangerous for the cells.
Okay, so picking up on that, are there a number of diseases which have been identified which specifically relate to problems with mitochondria?
Yeah, there are a variety of diseases which actually are related to mitochondria. There is a common sense, a common way to associate to mitochondria every metabolic dysfunction occurring, happening with the important clinical features. So far the disease related to genetic alteration within the mitochondrial DNA are still very few and in some extent poorly characterized, and definitely very difficult to be treated therapeutically for the patients. If you want to summarize, if you want to put them in a framework of disease, we can actually define that the majority of myopathies are related to mitochondrial modification in the genes, in a very few genes produce mitochondria.
So those are problems with the muscle then?
Yeah, because actually which are the tissue more energy need, the muscle, and also another important organs which actually is an extremely need of energy, this is the CNS, and now is more and more coming along evidences which relate to some of the main CNS disease such as Parkinson's to dysfunction in mitochondria. If you just want to bear in mind one of the main diseases related to modification in the genes encoding for mitochondrial protein, in genes expressed by the mitochondrial DNA, and before doing that, we should probably state that there are very limited number of genes coded by mitochondria, something like 37 genes, no more than that, but they are key for the... respiratory activity of mitochondria. So one of these main diseases is probably the MELAS syndrome, which actually MELAS stands for the acronym of mitochondrial encephalopathy, lactic acidosis, and stroke-like episodes. Right. So we have these really harsh phenotypes with this subject, which besides having this weakness in the muscle activities due by the high level of acidic lactic they have in the muscles, also they may occur in stroke-like episodes, which can have, most of the cases, some fatal events. And other pathologies related and identified to specific gene encoded by the mitochondrial DNA is also the MERV syndrome, which actually is a myoclonic epilepsy associated with rugged red fibers, which still is a evident clinical phenotype to muscle disorders.
Okay, so these are sort of human syndromes that have been identified specifically relating to
mitochondria,
particular mitochondrial gene
defects. And this actually, this is the syndromes which actually are have become clear in a relatively young age. Interested and involved in the mitochondrial field, a lot of pediatricians, and in my case, one of our stronger link and collaboration with clinicians are related to pediatricians, interesting, right, to understand, to define better how these phenotypes occurs and whether it's...
And of course, I mean, these defects are then showing up in children primarily, or earliest...
Absolutely.
Okay, but I mean, conversely, is there a relationship between declining mitochondrial function and with age?
Yeah, this is a very, I mean, accurate question, and probably one of the most interesting and ill-defined topic related to mitochondria. To define this, I mean, the relation to aging is basically related to a reduction in the efficiency of mitochondria.
Right.
As said, mitochondria is a complex and incredible machinery which keeps producing, I mean, I don't want to go too much into details, but maybe this is interesting, which actually basic, what I mean, the function is consisting in producing, creating a protons gradient through the various complexes of the mitochondrial respiratory chain. Mm-hmm. And this gradient is used by an enzyme based at the end of the respiratory chain called the ATP synthase, which couples ATP. And what actually is not taken up, the protons that are not taken up by the enzymes, generally produce molecules of waters. However, sometimes the respiratory chain activity is not so efficient, or the proton flux is hampered or not efficiently coupled. Mm-hmm. Therefore, some of these protons produce very dangerous species, such as the reactive oxygen species,
okay,
which leads to the oxidative stress of, right, mitochondria and then of the cells. So when we actually talking about mitochondrial function related to aging, the main point regards the production of reactive oxygen species.
Okay. So it's associated with a breakdown of the coupling between protons, the proton gradient, and ATP synthesis. So this basically ends up in a reduction of these nasty reactive oxygen species.
Absolutely. It's like, I mean, it's very, very easy. Do an example like that, like an engine, you know. Sometimes an engine works at 100%, sometimes less.
Yes.
And even when it works at 100%, you will have some deficiency. And this deficiency becomes bigger and bigger going through the age. So, and this is the reason why we become older, or at least we are not juvenile anymore. It's because,
yes, I mean, it seems very much that aging is associated with increase in reactive oxygen
species.
Yeah,
this is the theory warmly supported by all mitochondriologists. And in some extent, we have interesting experimental evidence for them. However, still there are limiting steps. Just considering, for example, that if the ROS production is increased, the reactive oxygen species is increased, what happens consequently is a third damaging on the mitochondrial DNA. Therefore, an alteration, therefore what you would expect is a further alteration or hampering of the respiratory chain capacity. However, this has not been demonstrated other way around. So, for example, that increased mutations in mitochondria produced an increase in ROS production.
Right, okay, so it's still a provisional link at the moment.
Yeah, provisional link, okay. But seems to make effect because, I mean, it's, as I said, in a car, what actually you're looking for when you have a problem is the engine, such as in the eukaryotic cells. So you have a problem related to mitochondria.
Yeah. Okay, so I mean, your research principally focuses around the mitochondrial ATPase. So perhaps you could tell us exactly how it does its job of coupling these two processes and how this is regulated, or in sort of general terms.
The ATP synthase is probably the key enzymes within mitochondria, because as said, it uses the protons to make ATP. Of course, this has been extensively studied, and also the definition of this mechanism has been awarded with three Nobel Prizes, one in the if I'm not wrong, in the 87 for Mitchell for the definition of the ATP synthase mechanism, and third to Boyer and Sergeant Walker for the 10 years later for the third contribution given to this discovery. So as this is a really a landmark in the mitochondria.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? It's basically an enzyme, a very complex enzyme, because it's combined by two main parts. One part located within the inner mitochondrial membrane, and the other one, the F1 part, staying within the mitochondrial matrix.
Right.
And it's just a machinery who runs, who turns, keep turning in a way, in circle, and according to the proton flux coming from the respiratory chain. However, as every enzyme, the ATP synthase can have not just a forward activity, as is defined, that associated to ATP production, but it also possesses a backward activity.
Right.
And actually, the backward activity of mitochondria is the limiting point, the limiting step to end up in pathological conditions.
So, in other words, that the enzyme can obviously function bidirectionally. So, obviously, therefore, it's quite key how this these two functions are regulated.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, this is the point. So, until the enzymes gets the energy, gets the gradient to go on with its activity, when the protons comes from the respiratory chain, it produces ATP, no problem. This can be done in a more or less efficient way. It doesn't really matter, because this is not not crucial for the mitochondria and then for the cells. However, when the mitochondria, these enzymes, doesn't feel anymore or doesn't receive anymore the proton flux,
mm-hmm.
what actually occurs is that it starts to run backward. So the four, rather than producing ATP, it starts to catalyzes ATP, so to destroy ATP,
right.
to consume ATP.
Yeah.
And this just because it wants to preserve the mitochondrial membrane potential, so it wants to preserve the proton gradient. And this actually we can be really linked to the fact that this organelle is just that a symbiontic that we have in the cells, which actually is helping us until the conditions are fine. There is no problem in supplying him what for of what he wants, but when the oxygen support is somehow reduced or blocked, as occurs in ischemia, what happens is that these organelles becomes extremely selfish, and rather than helping us, it becomes a big threat for the homeostasis and then the survival of the cells.
Okay, so in fact, when for example, the blood supply is compromised and there's ischemia in the tissue, what
Absolutely.
You're saying is that the enzyme changes its activity to preserve the mitochondria, and that is obviously not a good thing for the cell as a whole.
Yeah, and definitely it's not a good thing also for it, because,
right.
I mean, as soon as the cells collapse, the mitochondria collapse subsequently. However, the fascinating and really intriguing message is that the symbionte does act as an external organism soon as it doesn't receive the supply, the energy supply it wants.
Right.
It is actually is really, I mean, incredible. For example, we can provide our audience with some nice example that when you during ischemia induced in cardiomyocytes, if you add a simple drug named oligomycin, which is a specific antibiotic for ATP synthase, which blocks the ATP synthase,
mm-hmm.
if you add this compound to the cells, you can really delay the collapse of the cells, because the consumption
right.
of ATP driven by mitochondria is tangibly delayed when the enzyme's backward activity is happening.
Okay, so if you can actually inhibit the enzyme and therefore sort of slow down this process, which is
absolutely.
Which is counterproductive for the cell.
Absolutely.
Okay. So in your recent paper, I think it's in the July issue, in fact, of the journal Cell Metabolism, you have discussed extensively the importance of inhibitor factor 1 in potentially as an important controlling factor for the ATP synthase. Perhaps you can tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah. When I moved from my country to London to work with Professor Michael Duchenne, is a leading figure in the mitochondrial field, working close to us at the University College of London, we're interested to explore further this mitochondrial paradox. The mitochondrial paradox consisting is in the fact that they are not just ATP producers, but also can become the most harmful ATP consumers during ischemia.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, thankfully, a protein coded by the nucleus, which is called inhibitor factor 1, which is produced by the nucleus. It stays in the mitochondria, it stays next to the ATP synthase, and when the ATP synthase begins its backward nasty activity, what happens is that these enzymes, these proteins, changes its structural conformation and stops the enzymes to consume it.
Okay, so this is an example then of the, if you like, the mammalian side of the DNA.
Precisely.
Influencing
Precisely.
The mitochondrial function,
yeah.
And trying to prevent it,
yeah.
Basically causing problems in, for example, ischemia.
Yeah. It's okay. I mean, evolutionistically, is present in almost all the cells which have mitochondria. So it's a sort of controller of mitochondria.
Right, so it's very widely expressed then.
It's very widely expressed.
Okay.
However, I mean, the key message is that the mammalian cells have been able to evolve an efficient mechanism to stop this activity. And what actually is surprising is that we also, for the first time, discovered that the relative expression level of the protein in respect of the enzymes does not stay equal among tissues, but for example in the heart, where actually a stroke episode or a reduced flux of blood can be extremely dangerous, the relative expression level of the protein is increased compared to the ATP synthase.
Right, so you can see this in action.
Actually,
and I guess
in
that's
action.
Especially in the heart, because it's a very oxidative organ.
Absolutely, and also very interesting. Also at the level of the central nervous system, what we have is that, for example, neurons have this protein more expressed than astrocytes, meaning
right.
that actually there is a balance between need to be active in a certain conditions. In certain tissues rather than others.
Okay, so obviously it sounds very much like the IF1 protein is expressed according to how oxidative the tissue is and how important, therefore, it is to control the activity of the mitochondria.
Yeah. We can say that his expression is probably regulated by the need of the tissue to be protected during ischemic episodes. However, it has to be said that is probably the low level of oxygen which drives the overexpression of the protein.
Right.
We are now exploring that.
So do you think there is potential then, for example, in the management of ischemic episodes, then to try and target this protein, upregulate this protein in a therapeutic way?
Yeah, we actually, we have a big argument with the referees who says that this protein probably isn't relevant during heart attacks or events which reduce the blood flux to the cells. However, we actually see that when the protein is overexpressed, we see a protection of almost 40%, which can maybe end up in a timing of 20-30 minutes of delay of gravity of an ischemic episode. And as you know, minutes are crucial.
If you're having a heart attack, I guess 20-30 minutes could make the difference.
Yeah, I mean, for example, if I could have a 40% of survival of my cardiac cells in a heart attack, I would be more than pleased.
Okay, so that looks like there's some interesting potential there. So what are you actually doing now to follow up this research? What sort of particular angle are you interested in?
Yeah, the angle is that we didn't believe since the very beginning that this protein could have role just during pathological conditions. Because it's true that as a controller, it's true that this has a fantastic defensive mechanism, but the fact that this protein lies at the very heart of mitochondrial function is a very crucial crucial position among the dimers of the ATP synthase, because these enzymes are generally kept in couple along the inner mitochondrial membrane, probably to improve their efficiency of ATP production. We checked and we explored whether an effect led by the protein also the basic physiology. And what we saw is actually the expression level of the protein, does alter the function and the structure of mitochondria. And personally, I'm really very interested how to define now how this modulation in the mitochondrial structure can affect the cell response during chemotherapy treatment, so to induction of apoptotic response, for example. So there is a sort of variety. Just to be better and more focused and linked on the previous question, what actually we are now trying to design as a pharmacologist myself, a specialist myself, is to define a peptide which can regulate the protein activity in a very efficient way.
Okay, that would head towards a nice therapeutic outcome. Okay, well, Michelangelo, thank you very much for your time and for explaining very clearly your work into mitochondria and their importance in cell biology and disease.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you for your time and interest in listening to the latest edition of the RBC podcast. I hope very much that we'll have your company again next time around. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggestions about the podcast, please email them to us at podcast@rbc.ac.uk. Thanks for listening.